morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome to the Sage Sayers. I'm DG McCullough, Debbie Gardner McCullough. I'm a communications coach, a narrative coach, and a mental fitness coach from New Zealand, based in the fine state of Wisconsin. In each episode, we unpack communications tips and strategies, and we're always looking for interesting individuals from all around the world who found the gift, an opportunity, or even some knowledge from life's setbacks and challenges. In this week's Sage Sayers podcast, I'm reading from my Medium channel, an article I wrote, A Musings on the Passing of a Monarch, celebrating my dearest remote leader, dear Queen Elizabeth II, who had a huge impact on me as a New Zealander. As England laid their dear Queen to rest this week, the BBC called the passing of Queen Elizabeth II the moment history stops. But for this coach and correspondent from New Zealand, one of the 54 countries within the coalition of the British Commonwealth, fond memories of Queen Elizabeth and the steady reassurance she offered prevail. Queen Elizabeth too also offers leadership lessons women all over can learn from, both in leadership presence and in communications. I'm outlining a few memories and musings in this week's post. Memories from the valleys of South Canterbury, New Zealand. My earliest memories of Queen Elizabeth stem from my grandmother, Margaret, a true royalist who faithfully watched the Queen's Boxing Day messages on December 26th, televised from London to all her Commonwealth constituents, and before that, via radio. I remember dressing up nicely, sitting cross-legged on my grandmother's living room floor, sometimes with my cousins, or at least with my sister, to watch the Queen's speech. My father, Evan, recalls from his boyhood, gathering around a brown leather-bound radio, listening with his siblings to what their dear Queen had to say. My grandmother, like many in her generation, budgeted each year for expensive photo books chronicling a year in the lives of the royals, shunned any negative media attention, and felt fiercely loyal instead. Listening to her super posh voice seemed foreign and ever formal, but a steady consistency we could rely upon. Provided the Queen gave her speech, we'd had a reasonable year, and we could feel hope for the next. I was born in 1970, so these memories stem from my third year through to my early 20s when I left New Zealand for overseas. The Queen's image dotted our currency, postage stamps, tea towels, teapots, and calendars. Through visits, we connected with dear Queen Elizabeth, who visited New Zealand at least twice that I remember in my lifetime, and a total of 10 visits throughout her life. Prince Charles and Princess Diana, with baby William, visited once. As a schoolgirl in 1981, I waited hours on a tree-lined street with my peers from St. Margaret's College to wave to our Queen as she drove by. I chose to stand and not wave when the moment arrived, just so I could focus on her face. I felt amazed that she smiled authentically and that her gaze seemed warm, even kind. When Queen Elizabeth travelled further down south on that same trip to the South Island, she stopped at Timaru in Caroline Bay, the nearest town to my grandmother's farm, where my grandmother joined other artists to welcome the Queen. Lo and behold, the Queen stopped where my grandmother painted sweet forget-me-nots on porcelain trinket boxes and engaged in a dialogue with her about her art. The serendipity, the pride that she chose her booth over others, and the kind way the Queen spoke became the happiest moment in her life, my grandmother often said. To my grandmother and her generation, the Queen was someone to admire, look up to, even emulate. The infamous uniform we saw on our Queen in the tabloids and in those well-thumbed photo books was one that my grandmother's generation emulated, in some small measure, with delight. A pervasive, queenish culture. My grandmother's era of woman often wore A-line skirts and kilts, button-down shirts and blouses with Guernsey jerseys in the winter. Pearls tightish at the neck stayed a staple. Hair stayed bobbed and short, just like the Queen's. In fact, I can't recall anyone in my grandmother nor my mother's era not dressing up and doing their makeup and hair as soon as they woke, even if they saw nobody throughout their day. This formality we learned from our Queen brought a standard of showing up, something we wanted to adhere to, no matter what. Customs like afternoon and morning tea with three-tiered plates of biscuits, finger sandwiches, and sponges oozing with fresh cream and homemade jams prevailed in New Zealand homes throughout my girlhood and my teens. And all of this modelled the Queen's love for the countryside and for her British culture. The well-bred South Cantabrians, the bucolic province in which I grew up, also tried sounding like the Queen. "Hello, how are you?" said in a queenish, posh kind of way, signalled to many, money, status, well-travelled, true royalist. And for many, this branding felt good. Even when the Queen's children's marriages fell apart and tabloids ran their scandals, this seemed to do no harm to brand nor reputation in New Zealand. We understood. She's a queen, not a god. She's human. And her children too. Things did shift. For my generation, the Queen and the culture she represented seemed a bit stodgy. Mostly because of her formal, stilted language, but also because it did not feel truly New Zealand. Some questioned, especially when her family life became fraught, and later when Princess Diana died, why we ought to emulate the royals at all. A new showing of loyalty. New Zealand's culture underwent steady changes which reflected this divided view of England and of our Queen. By 1984, my 14th year, New Zealand's card makers replaced wintry scenes on Christmas cards with Santa on a surfboard and other images depicting our summery Christmas weather. We abandoned spraying fake snow on our windows to emulate what our Queen might experience on her Christmas day and stopped creating hot five-course turkey meals on December 25 as well. With this independent way of celebrating New Zealand as its own nation versus a spin-off from England, Kiwis all over, including my family, started embracing their own cuisine and their own seasons. We finessed our barbecues with punchy marinades made from South Pacific fruits like feijoa, tamarillos and kiwi fruit. Christmas feasts included cooled baked hams, salads and farm-picked berries. One rebellious year, we even moved the table outside to the cooler garden. That hot, five-course traditional British Christmas meal we hosted instead in June, our coldest month of the year, and called it a solstice dinner. These seemingly small moves started planting the seed. We can love and stay loyal to our Queen, but still be our own people too. A new, strategic connection. For my generation, a new way to stay loyal to the Queen started in our college years when leaving on our OE, our overseas experience, an obligatory, almost mandatory roam abroad. Most employers or graduate college level courses requested travel from young New Zealand professionals before they take you seriously within your field. That Commonwealth connection with our Queen meant New Zealanders inherited an automatic working holiday visa in the UK. This was a big win for smaller countries and economies with fewer career options. Most college friends, like many young New Zealanders, travelled in packs to London where they piled into flats, saving for epic safaris across Africa or using London as a springboard to the rest of Europe. I resisted London and the UK, even Europe, aside from sporadic trips, because I wanted something different, something more foreign to the New Zealand I'd left behind. Part of this stemmed, perhaps, from living in Asia for part of my childhood, including Brunei, which joined the Commonwealth in 1984, and then Pakistan, which rejoined in 1989. But even in Japan, where I worked from ages 21 to 26, and now the US, where I've lived since 1996, I still relate to the UK, as I do to New Zealand. I find no coincidence that the publications that I dreamt of writing for and had the pleasure and honour of writing for are all British. I chose The Economist magazine out of all magazines as a style to emulate as I trained as a younger journalist. When I visited my editors at The Economist and the Financial Times of London in their London headquarters, I felt hugely proud, like I'd arrived. I felt safe and familiar in the city and delighted in the British language that I'd grown up hearing on TV, with all of its delightful, crisp and witty dryness. So while I chose not to live in the UK and cash in on that working holiday visa option, its culture and the leadership of its queen has still guided me throughout my career. Learnings on leadership from my queen. I promised at the top end of this Musings article that leadership lessons from the Queen will come, and I feel many exist. One lesson stems from the ability to connect to audiences remotely, something that many of my coachees struggle with. The Queen was a pioneer, a true pro, because she saw no boundaries, and nor ought we. Video and phone calls still allow us to read cues, stay kind, and ask curious questions. Her royal tours were prolific. New Zealand's government tracks that in 1953 to 1954, she visited 46 centres and attended 110 functions. So that meant 3 out of 4 New Zealanders saw the Queen on that trip. The Queen strategically and in a clever way knew, popping in now and then on site can build lasting, memorable connections. I find an additional lesson in personal branding from our Queen, especially as a woman, who made up for her short stature by wearing bright colours and hats so that others might notice her more easily. And she was right. Bright colours, especially on camera, make us seem more awake, energised and alert. That we could recognise our Queen from her staples and hats, jewellery, Anello and David shoes, etc., brings comfort and consistency. I like that my clients know that I wear Diane von Furstenberg dresses and wrap tops and jewellery by Devon Lee, because these fit my tall frame, my personality, but also remain consistent. While many, including me in my youth, often criticise the Queen's formal tone, today, I believe she stayed audience-centred and strategic. Sounding any less formal would have whittled away precious credibility that she needed as a younger woman monarch, especially at age 25 when she took the throne. Besides, that's how she learned to speak and how others around her spoke, so she stayed authentic too. That she asked curious questions to the people she met brought warmth and charm that made up for that formal tone. Often she'd ask, "Have you come far?" to those who'd probably driven from miles away. Even to my grandmother, on that visit to her country town, the Queen asked curious questions on how my grandmother had learned her China painting craft. That my grandmother was self-taught amazed her. I chose Musings of a Monarch as my topic this post, as I'm saddened by an end of an era where this one constant in my life, my Queen Elizabeth II, has ended. I feel amazed by her life of service and grateful for the many fond memories and lessons I've learned from the culture she emerged from and fiercely upheld. May her spirit and her leadership prevail. want to thank my coachees who lift me up each week and they inspire every episode that we recreate in this podcast. Thanks also to my producer, Dotan Aini. He's also known as Titan 32 on Fiverr. Thanks for editing this podcast, Dotan. And thank you for listening. In the show notes, you'll find the link to my Medium article that I just read from. And get ready for that soft launch of my business communication workshops. It's all in the makings, including the first workshop, which is writing your CV and work story like a journalist. It's a three-part series coming soon. You'll find those posts on LinkedIn under the hashtag Brave Communicators. That's it for me this week. Thanks again for listening. Bye for now.